Good morning, everyone.
It's good to be here again. It's really special to have Dawson here this morning. I've also worked for GTO, so I've gotten the privilege to work alongside Dawson some over the last year and a half, and it's been a privilege. He's a good man. We're excited to have him be a part of Kazakh. I also want to just thank you guys in advance for the part that you guys will play in supporting him and his time following God's call wherever he leads him through Kazakh. So I'm really excited for this morning. I get to talk about what I'm most passionate about. We'll get into it. We'll go fast. They said I have to keep it under 3 hours, so we'll get right moving. I want to talk this morning a little bit about, I want to tell you about missions. It'd be neat if the slideshow would work too. Give me 1 second. Okay, there we go. So I want to talk about missions, but first, before we can talk about missions and what that's about, we have to go back and talk about story, because missions is part of a much larger story. I want to tell a little piece of my story.
Yeah. Testing? Okay. Oh, that's better.
So, I want to tell a little piece of my story. I want to go back to when I was 22, which is a little longer than you might expect. I was incredibly blessed. Opportunities to do a bunch of different things. So at 22, I had been a crop duster for 3 years, which is kind of a fun project, and was now helping to build a large business, working for people like Justin Bieber and the Fast and Furious franchise, a place that we had our own jet to get us around. And there I got to do my 3 favorite things in the world. I got to help lead a business, make sure that we had a basketball court and a volleyball court, pool and ping pong tables, massage chairs and beanbags, and that everybody was living their best life. And also got to fly and to write code. And those were like my favorite things to do. So that was kind of a dream job. I had more money than I knew what to do with. If I wanted something, I bought it. I had a lot of hobbies. It was actually really cool to see you show the rocket. One of the pieces that I did was I got into rockets. I actually had my license to launch to the edge of space. Was racing, traveling a bunch, surfing, paintballing, you name it, got to do it. I was competing in archery at an international level. Was actually supposed to be going to the Olympic tryouts until God changed the direction of my life. In short, I had everything I wanted. Like, short of a $100 million yacht, like, I had everything I wanted. Like, there wasn't anything left on the wish list. I was really, like, living what I thought was the dream and enjoying life. At this point in my life, at 22, I'd been a Christian for about 2 years, and I was every bit as passionate about being a Christian as any of those other things that I got to do. But especially for the last year of that time, like, really felt that something was missing. I felt like I was holding a piece back, like I was holding something back that I hadn't surrendered, but I couldn't put a finger on it. I didn't know what it was. And I was like asking God for it, like show me what it is. Like, I'm willing to give it up, but I didn't know what it was. Excuse me. I was going through life and I wasn't sure what the purpose was. And then my friend gave me a book called Radical, and it's about like our calling. It's about what it really means to be a Christian. The urgency with which we're supposed to live and like the calling God gave for all of us. And I found what was missing. I found the purpose that God had created me for. And it blew my mind and it completely captured my attention. I had just built a really big electronics lab in my basement. Bunch of 3D printers and different stuff there and some other cool stuff. And I'd come home from work and I'd just disappear into the lab and not come back out. I wouldn't even go to bed at night. I'd just sleep in my chair for a bit and then keep goofing off there. And was like, I really enjoyed being there. And like when God showed me this piece, like this purpose, this calling, like it so captured my attention that it was an entire month before I even set foot in that lab again. Because I was spending every waking moment like, like reading the word and like searching for like, what is this calling? Like, what does it mean? How do I practically live in the way that God is calling me to? Like, I had found a purpose, the calling of the Great Commission, and I found a story worth living for, like something that mattered. It's a good book. Not everyone has to go read that book. That was a cool tool that God used to meet me at the spot I was at in life there. That all led to God calling me to go overseas and to actually walk away from and give away everything that I had. And it was the hardest thing that I had done at that point in my life. It felt really big. My first overseas experience was a month on charge with GTO, went to Tibet to what used to be the largest Buddhist monastery in the world. And I spent a month there, and there's a language barrier. Not hardly anyone that we met spoke English the entire month. So we basically were prayer walking for a month, and I wasn't really sure why that was important. Like, I was pretty confident that God could hear me from the couch at home, and I wouldn't have to eat the food that they had there, because they were vegetarians, and I'm not a vegetarian. So I want to leave that story for just a little bit. We'll just pause that and leave it. We'll come back to it in a bit. So stories. We all have little stories every day. You have the story of your Sunday morning, how you came here this morning. We all have our own life story that God's been writing in our life since the day we were born. Sometimes it's hard to see how those little stories play into the bigger story. Sometimes we don't get to see till later or even at all. And then there's stories that are bigger than just our life story. Together we have bigger stories. So you guys have the story of your church here. And it includes a bunch of people. We have the story of our Anabaptist history. And that goes back like a long ways and includes a lot of people. We have stories from the Bible. So many stories. And we have the story of all of humanity. Since creation. The whole world. It's a big story. So what are the stories about? Like, is there any common thread that runs through all these stories, from our little stories to the stories in the Bible and everything in between? Back in the beginning, we see God creating us, and then we fall. We lose perfection, and we lose the perfect relationship with God. And from that point forward, what is every story about? Like, is there anything in common with the stories from that point forward? So, first of all, we see on the day that Adam and Eve fell, God meet them in the garden. And was there judgment and punishment? Yes. But also, there was a way made from that first day for them to be restored into relationship with God. There was already a plan. And then Moses and the children of Israel, like, what a roller coaster. We see story after story of them like wandering away from God and him always like pursuing them and like calling them back to relationship with himself. Sometimes through difficult things, but always calling them back to relationship with himself. Jesus comes, and he makes the ultimate sacrifice. He tore down the veil in the temple like to signify our direct relationship being restored to him, not through a priest, not by a sacrifice, but direct relationship with Jesus. And then we see Paul and the apostles travel throughout the known world, taking the story of the gospel, inviting people to be restored to relationship with God. Nate Saint, Jim Elliot, Hudson Taylor, like so many people, gave or spent their lives taking this story, this message of restoring people to relationship with God. So do you see what's happening? Oh, I missed one. Revelations. John got to see a day in heaven where someone from every tribe and tongue and nations was standing before the throne praising God. Restored to perfect relationship with God. So do you see like what's happening? Like all the stories seem to have this common thread. And I would like to propose it's not because they're little stories and they happen to be similar. Like if you see a book and there's a bunch of chapters, like the chapters are stories too, but they're not as meaningful by themselves because they're part of a bigger story. And in the same way, I propose that all of these stories, every little story since the beginning of time, is part of one larger story that God has been writing in all of time. That all of these little stories are just a chapter or a verse in a story that God is writing since Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden to that day that John saw in heaven. One story. Story that God's been writing about restoration of relationship. It's why He created us in the first place, because He wanted relationship with us. I've been talking about this larger story for a long time, and I'm really passionate about it. Just recently, though, a few of my friends and I had the opportunity to read through the Bible in 6 days, and it blew my mind to see that perspective of just all at once seeing the whole Bible, like how much it truly is one story, not separate, not disconnected, just one continuous story of God pursuing relationship with us. It's an incredible story. So how do missions connect with this larger story? Like, first of all, I would like to do away with the term missions and just start getting everybody on the same page that there's only one story. It's God's story, and we figure out how to live in it. But let my beef with that word aside. Where do we start with missions? So obviously, let's start with the Bible. It is the only concrete truth that we have in writing today. Where does the Bible say? We have the mandate. We've all seen this, something we're familiar with. So let me lend just a little bit of context to this before we talk about it. So this is, you guys remember when we were young, and finally mom let us stay home when she went to town to go shopping. And we didn't have to go along if we didn't want to go shopping. We got to stay at home and play. But as she left, there was always this kind of like, okay, now make sure you behave while I'm gone, and don't eat the cookies and do your chores. Like, there was this like important stuff when she left. Well, this is Jesus leaving. This is the kind of important message that He left us with. Or from another perspective, like when someone gets to the end of their life, the last words that they give us are really meaningful. Because as they look back over their entire lifetime, like, what's important? What's the piece that they have to share with us? Like, this is Jesus' last words. Like, this is Him leaving and giving us the most important piece. And what does He say? First, He qualifies Himself. I have been given all authority in the universe. And what does He give us? One instruction: go therefore and make disciples of all nations. Now, I have to dive into this piece for just a second before we go on with story, because it's really important that we understand our calling in this and its urgency. So I want to clarify, because this gets lost sometimes, that this says make disciples of all the nations. This piece is important. It doesn't say make a lot of disciples. That's good. We need to make a lot of disciples. But this is a very specific command to make disciples of all nations. Matthew 28, 18, 19 says, of all nations. Matthew 24, 14, the good news about the kingdom will be preached throughout the whole world so that all the nations will hear it. Revelations 5, 9, your blood has ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nations. Revelation 7, 9, that verse John saw in heaven. I saw a vast crowd, too great to count, from every nation and tribe and people and language. This is important. It's not to make a lot of disciples. That's important too, but it's very specifically to make disciples of all nations. There are about 3 billion people in the world who have not yet heard the gospel, who have not had a chance to be restored, have not been invited to be in relationship with God. It's a lot of people. What happens to these people when they face God in eternity without having heard? The Bible is really clear on this. Do all people have knowledge of God? Romans 1, 18 to 21. But God shows His anger from heaven against all sinful, wicked people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. They know the truth about God because He's made it obvious to them. For ever since the world was created, people have seen the earth and sky. Through everything God made, they can clearly see His invisible qualities, His eternal power and divine nature. So they have no excuse for not knowing God. So all people have knowledge of God. Have all people sinned and rejected God? Romans 3, 10 to 12. As the scriptures say, no one is righteous, not even one. No one is truly wise. No one is seeking God. All have turned away. All have become useless. No one does good, not a single one. Romans 3, 23. For everyone has sinned. We all fall short of God's glorious standard. Romans 5, 12. When Adam sinned, sin entered into the world. Adam's sin brought death, so death spread to everyone, for everyone sinned. All people have sinned and rejected God? Are all people condemned for sinning and rejecting God? Romans 3:19 and 20. Obviously the law applies to those to whom it was given for its purpose to keep people from having excuses and to show that the entire world is guilty before God. For no one can ever be made right with God by doing what the law commands. The law simply shows us how sinful we are. Romans 5:18. Yes, Adam's one sin brings condemnation for everyone, but Christ's one act of righteousness brings right relationship with God and new life for everyone. Romans 6:23. For the wages of sin is death, but the free gift of God is eternal life through Christ Jesus our Lord. We are condemned for sinning and for rejecting God. And did God provide a single way of salvation from this condemnation? Acts 4:12. There is salvation in no one else. God has given no other name under heaven by which we must be saved. Like, if there was another way, it would mean it wasn't necessary, it wasn't important for Jesus to die on the cross, if there was some other way. And if people were innocent until they had been told, if there was some free pass for people who hadn't had the chance to be told about the gospel, then the worst possible thing we could do would be to tell them, because then there's a chance that they would reject it. How do we fit into this? Romans 10:13-15. It's really clear. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. But how can they call on him to save them unless they believe in him? And how can they believe in him if they've never heard about him? And how can they hear about him unless someone tells them? And how will anyone go and tell them without being sent? So what's the point of failure in there? What piece can be missing? Let's just walk through it backwards. God has sent his followers. Will we go and tell? That's on us. If we go and tell, they will hear. If they hear, they will believe. Not everyone, but those who are ready, those who want to hear. If they hear, they will believe. If they believe, they will call. And if they call, God will save them. Every one of those is a will. Every one of those is concrete and handled by God, except one. Will we go and tell them? Will we tell people? And that's where I didn't read the end of verse 15 there. This is what the scriptures say. How beautiful are the feet of the messengers who bring good news. Because we are the piece in there that's critical. The one piece that can break in that chain. Are we telling? So how are we actually doing? Right now, for the past few years, 10 or less, we are, for the first time since Jesus walked the earth, we are losing. The ratio is going backwards of Christians to non-Christians. For the first time in history, less people are becoming Christians than the population is growing. That has never happened before. We have always been gaining in numbers, slowly, but gaining. For the first time in history, we are losing. Of the missionaries we send out, which isn't that huge a percentage of our people, 97% go to places that already have the gospel, that have people in the same culture, who speak the language, that can spread the gospel. 97% go to places that already have the gospel. And of the money we tithe, which is actually a lot of money, but not that huge a percentage of the blessings that we have, we give a small amount to missions. A lot of that money goes to buildings and programs and other cool things. And I'm not saying those pieces are wrong. Those are good too. But of the piece that goes to missions, 99% of missional funding goes to places that already have the gospel. 99%. There are 3 billion people who have not heard the gospel, who have not been told, and who do not have a relative or friend or coworker or neighbor or anyone that they will bump into that will ever tell them about the gospel. Aside from something changing, they will never hear the gospel. 3 billion people. They are facing an eternity in hell, as we just saw the Bible says. And if we stand idly by, their blood will be on our hands. To whom much is given, much will be required. So we have a lot to do. This is a tall order. In fact, for most of my life, I considered this to be impossible. Like, 3 billion people, where do you even start? Like, or maybe, like, okay, so we know we get it done. The Bible says so. But, like, maybe it's in 1,000 years or several thousand years. Like, 3 billion people, like, where do you even go with that? It's never something that I would hope to see completed. So it's a big project. And we can try to dig into that because of, like, guilt, like, out of duty, or out of, like, compassion for lost people and the eternity that they face. And those are good things. But, like, we will burn out. Like, guilt and compassion are not good motivators. Like, if I look at 3 billion people, I could feel myself getting discouraged just looking at that without even getting started. Like, we have to have a motivation that's better than that. Like, the need is too overwhelming and the cost is too high to be motivated by guilt. There are some things that motivate me a lot. First and foremost, I stand in awe of God our Father. And because, like God is so incredible that, like, words cannot describe who He is and what He's done for us. And we don't have time for me to try this morning. But because of that awe of Him, like, I want to walk in relationship with Him. I want to know more of Him. And I want to invite other people into that awe of Him and into relationship with Him. And that's exactly what the Great Commission is to invite people into that relationship with God. There's so much more to say about that. We don't have time for it now. The other thing that really, like, motivates me is that larger story behind this command. The fact that since the beginning of time, God has been writing a story, and the whole story is about restoring people to relationship with Himself. What else is there for our stories to be about? Like, this is the whole story is about God restoring His people to Himself. Like, what else is there that matters for our stories to be about? Every smaller story in our lives is just a part of a larger narrative that God is writing. And I hope that, like, we find ways for them to fit into God's story and not to be our own story. So I want to go back and finish the story I started telling at the beginning. So I was living the dream. I had what I wanted. And I thought it was the best thing ever. And then my attention was fully captured by God's calling. And He called me to, like, walk away from the things that I had. And it was the hardest thing that I had ever done. But just 7 short months later, when I came back from my time on edge, the hardest thing that I could imagine was to go back to that dream. Because it seemed so small and so insignificant in comparison to the story that God was inviting me into. That story was all about me, and at the end of the day, it was never going to matter. Like, the story that God was writing was so much bigger and so much more important and was going to matter for eternity. It was so much more significant, and the joy and fulfillment that came in living in God's story instead of my own and pursuing the mission that He had given, like, so completely overshadowed the dream that I had before. It seemed so small and insignificant. It didn't even seem like a sacrifice to walk away from. It seemed like something easy to give up for something much better. So another thing that just makes me incredibly excited for this mission, for finishing the mission, is this verse. This is hands down my favorite verse in the Bible, Revelation 7, 9, and 10. I saw a vast crowd, too great to count, from every tribe and people and language. This is John looking into heaven. God gave him a glimpse. Standing in front of the throne and before the Lamb, and it says they were shouting with a great roar praises to God. Hallelujah. Like, I can't wait to see that day. Like, of people from every tribe and tongue and nations restored to perfect relationship with God. Like, we can't even imagine what it will be like to be in the presence of God. I'm excited for that day. So this is kind of like, this is for those of you guys who, you start reading a book and you skim the last chapter before you read the rest of the book. Like, this is it. John got to peek ahead at the last chapter in this story that God's writing. And we see that we get it finished. Like, there's a day in heaven where someone from every tribe and tongue and nations is there. Matthew 24:14 is pretty cool as well. It says, really simply, the good news of the kingdom will be preached through the whole world. All the nations will hear it, and the end will come. And, like, isn't that the goal for all of us as Christians, is to see that day when redemption comes full circle? Perfect relationship with God restored. So yes, the Great Commission is an incredibly tall order. But we know we get it finished. Now here's the part that blows my mind. We could see it finished in our lifetime. I believe that with all of my heart. And it is the highest goal of my life to do everything that I can to be able to see this day before I die. Because I'm confident that it's possible. That's a bit of a bold statement. Let me explain that. This is because of the ways that God is opening the door for us in supernatural ways. Like, we might be the first generation that has the possibility within our means to finish this in our lifetime. So let me explain. This chart, it's a bit ugly, but it shows the ratio of non-Christian people for every Christian person throughout time. So this is in the days of the apostles. There was 360 non-Christians for every practicing Christian. And you see that number get smaller throughout time until today it stands at 7 to 1. 7 non-Christian people for every Christian person. 7 to 1 seems a lot more doable than 3 billion. But it's actually better than 7 to 1 because if there were 7 non-Christian people for each of us, ooh, that's supposed to be blue, you can hardly see it. If there were 7 to 1, if we reached one person, together we could reach 2 more, and that would leave 4 to reach. If each of us could reach 4 people, 3 people, in our lifetime, we would reach not a person from every tribe and tongue and nations, but every single person left on earth. 3 people. 3 people seems a lot more doable. I need somebody to guess for me. If this represents an unreached people group, a group of people who have not yet heard the gospel, how many Christian churches are there for every single unreached people group? Anyone want to take a guess? Anyone? How many Christian churches do you think there are for each unreached people group that's left in the world? 20? That's about where I was at. How about 1,500? 1,500 churches for every unreached people group. And this is like evangelical Christian churches. This is not like we say we're Christian churches. 1,500 for every single unreached people group. So manpower is not the problem here. Let's talk a little bit about our resources. Let's make this a little more personal. So let's say this circle represents global Christians. This is Christians all throughout the world, people who say they're Christians. It's like 2.3 billion people. It's a lot of people. But let's bring it back a little bit. This is evangelical Christians. So this is people who believe in salvation through grace by faith. That's very similar to where we come out at a core. That's a lot of people. It's like 860 million. That sliver, and that sliver is not the right size. I made it bigger so you could see it. You couldn't see it if I made it the right size. Is us Anabaptists. We do not count for all that much in the grand scheme of Christianity. This is the piece of us that lives in America, which kind of surprised me. Most Anabaptist people actually live in Africa and South America. But let's bring this back to our people, like something that's familiar to our people here in America. And what resources do we have? And let's not talk about our income, because none of you want me digging into your pocket. Let's talk about our tithing money. We all tithe 10%, right? I need another guess, some brave volunteer. How much do you think that our tithing money, so remember, our little drop in the bucket of Anabaptist people, and only the ones of us that live in America and have some of the best income in the world, what do you think our tithing money adds up to in 1 year? If you've heard this before, you can't guess. I'll give you a hint, it's a really big number.
A billion.
That's good. 2.1 billion dollars every year of tithing money. You guys remember the little sliver that we are of Christianity. We may be insignificant in numbers, but what we have in resources, what God has given us, is not insignificant. $2.1 billion. Do you guys know what $2.1 billion does? Like, I don't. I haven't had that kind of money. But Wycliffe says that with $500 million in 15 years, they could finish translating the Bible in 99.9% of the languages left in the world today. That's less than a quarter of our little drop in the bucket of people, our tithing money, in a single year. Can you guys imagine for one second what a monumental impact that would have on finishing the mission to reach every group of people in their mother tongue with Jesus' words in the gospel? Resources are not a problem here. Christianity is exploding in other parts of the world. China went from less than a million Christians 50 years ago to more than 100 million today. And just for reference, that's about a third of the population of the U.S. in 50 years flat becoming Christians in a closed country under persecution. Every day, about 50,000 people around the world become Christians, and every week, there's about 3,500 churches planted around the world. God is doing incredible work. So the piece I said earlier of God opening the door for us in supernatural ways, like the way that God is orchestrating things with technology and travel, communication, the English language being adopted in other parts of the world, like God is opening the door in so many ways for us to be able to reach people in a way that's not been open before. I truly believe that this can be the end game of missions, that we can see the Great Commission finished. Like, let's be a part of it. I'm going to step back here for just one second and be really clear that when I talk about missions, I don't mean just going overseas. I mean finishing the mission wherever and however God has called us to. That might be right on our doorstep. It's so possible and so accessible to every one of us, no matter our stage of life or our circumstances. There's always a way to engage with reaching other people. Some of us are called to be right here. But overwhelmingly, the need is in other places and is largely being ignored by us as Christians as a whole. Just back to that piece of the current state of missions. Like, we're actually losing right now. But just imagine what we could do if we were to focus on this. Like, if seeing God glorified amongst the nations, if reaching people became the most important piece, like, above everything else of every single one of our lives, like, God has given us everything we need to do this. It's at our fingertips. What will we do with it? Imagine the story that we could live and how powerful an impact we could have in eternity. So, I want to move on from this just a little bit. I see, like, the stories in the Bible of God working and the way that Jesus, like, the miracles and stuff that he performed while he was on earth. And sometimes I wonder, like, is he still working the same way? Like, does that still work today? And then I stumbled across John 14:12. This blew my mind a little bit too. I tell you the truth. This is Jesus speaking, by the way. I tell you the truth that anyone who believes in me will do the same works that I have done and even greater works because I'm going to be with my Father. Like, let's just repeat that a little bit. Anyone who believes in me will do the same works that I have done and greater. How crazy is that? That Jesus himself said that we who believe in him will do greater works than he did. God is looking for opportunities for us to be outside of our comfort zone, at a place where we can't do it on our own, a place where he can work, where he can show himself powerful. I want to tell you just a few stories of how some of my friends and I have had front row seats to see God working in the past few years. There was a number of years back, we had a team of 9 guys, keep track of 9, who went to a really dark place spiritually, a place you can almost feel darkness and oppression. They went in to go to a new city that some long-term missionaries had been trying to get access to, and they just couldn't get a foot in the door. They couldn't penetrate the place at all. So they said, why don't you guys go in for a week and prayer walk and just, you know, bring the Spirit of God into this place and see see what he does. Several days in, they got questioned. They found this big temple in the middle of town, and they decided that they were going to, not for any fancy reason or anything, just for fun, they were going to play Jericho, and every day they were going to march around it and pray around it when they were prayer walking. Several days in, they got questioned. The police came and asked them, this was a closed country, and they were like, where's the rest of your group? And they're like, we're here. What do you mean? And they're like, no, there's more of you. Like, where are the rest of you? They said, no, it's just 9 of us. We're here. And the police said, no, there's been people all around town reporting that there's 27 foreigners walking around the temple every day. What are you guys doing? And they're like, no, there's just 9 of us. I don't know what you're hearing. I don't know what's going on, but there's just 9 of us. And eventually the police left them alone and they moved on. But they started to do the math. There's 9 of them, but people see 27. That's 2 extra for each of them. Like, interesting. Those guys were excited to go march around the temple the next few days yet. There's some really incredible pieces of that story that we don't have time for. You can ask me afterwards. But that entire town ended up accepting salvation, like coming into relationship with God and ending up reaching out to the places around them. There's some incredible pieces to what happened there. Another time, I love this story. Another similar place, really spiritually dark, in this type of, like, it's a mixture between just Buddhism and spirit worship. They invite a spirit or a demon to work with them as part of their training process. And this is, like, they have power to work with this spirit, and they do healing and all kinds of crazy things with this spirit. They usually have a room with some of their idols and statues and stuff in it where they do their spirit work. So, this team gets a tour of the temple, and there was an English-speaking monk there, and so he was taking them through into each of the rooms and showing them the different stuff and their statues and whatnot. And they weren't praying out loud. They didn't tell him that they were Christians or what they were doing. They were just tourists. And so they're walking around from room to room, going to different rooms, and they get to this one room, and he, like, jumps in front of them and holds them out of the room. Like, you guys can't go into this room. And they're like, that's weird. We went into all the other rooms. Like, what's up with this room? And he's like, He's like, you can look in. This is where I do my spirit work. My spirit lives in this room. But the spirit that's with you guys is stronger than my spirit and will drive my spirit away if you go into this room. You can't go in. Just like, wow. Like, they weren't even aware. Like, they weren't, like, praying out loud or anything. But the spirit of God being present with them, like, God says his spirit is with us. And God being present in that place, like, spiritual battle was being done. And this guy sensed that. And I think that's, like, I think that's what makes prayer walking make sense to me. Like, bringing God's presence into a place with us and the spiritual battle that happens there. I don't fully understand all of those pieces, but taking God's presence into a place with us is powerful. So I want to go back and finish the story that I started. My first time in Tibet. So we went to this Buddhist monastery. It used to be the largest Buddhist monastery in the world. 30 to 40,000 people live here, like, year round. And they are incredibly committed in a way that makes me feel ashamed sometimes, the way that I look at religion. Most of the people that are there, some of them commit for 7 or 13 years. Most of them that are there committed for 27 years of study at this place when they show up. It's incredibly beautiful, but incredibly dark. Like, to walk into their temples and stuff, like, you feel oppression. Like, you feel a weight. And, like, to walk out, like, you feel it lift. Like, you feel the darkness in this place. There's a gigantic prayer wheel. We had our tents pitched just up this road and over the top of the hill. And we'd walk down the street every day. You can see the people here. Like, this thing is huge. So we spent a month there. And we couldn't hardly talk to anyone, and we were prayer walking. And we got to the end of our month, and we left, and went back to eating our good food and praying from the couch. And I wasn't 100% sure why that was so important. Like, I knew it was a good thing to do, but I really wasn't sure why it was worthwhile, honestly. But a year later, I was back, I was on edge, and I got out to this place again. Actually, Derek and Shawnee were there. We were just a couple valleys over, and before we left, we decided, hey, let's run over and see what this place is like now. And Oh, I just want to mention, like, when we were there, we were walking the streets, everyday prayer walking. We were praying really specifically that God would tear down physical and spiritual strongholds. Like, in this place of so much darkness and oppression, a place where people were being taught, like, basically satanic worship, that God would tear down spiritual strongholds, physical and spiritual. So we get out there, and we're close by, and we get to a police checkpoint, and they will not let us go out there. They said no foreigners are allowed in this region anymore. And we were like, that's weird. Like, these people are a little bit radical, and the government is scared of them sometimes. So it's not entirely uncommon. So we went back into town nearby and started asking around, wanted to figure out what was going on out there. Why couldn't we go out? And finally found someone who knew what was going on. And I actually managed to get pictures of it later on. But the Chinese government had come in and was tearing most of the place to the ground. There's that big prayer wheel in the road we walk down every day. I actually helped build this wall while I was there. Just walked into a guy that was laying bricks there one day and helped him out and tried to communicate a bit. And at first, like, I didn't even know what to do with that. Like, I didn't know those people well, but I felt like some connection there, and I was just like shocked that someone would come in and just like tear their city down. And then on the day-long taxi ride back through China to get out to our airport, it was like, had to stop and think, like, did we not spend a month walking those streets specifically asking God to tear down physical and spiritual strongholds? And then I had to think about what I believe about prayer and like how small my faith really is. Like, did I really believe that God was even capable of, or that he would actually tear down strongholds? I can literally go on the rest of the day. There's so many incredible things that God is doing. He loves when we give him the opportunity, when we are out in a place where we will fail without him. He loves to show up. So I want to make a massive shift here, and I want to talk about how Kazakh fits into this, how Kazakh is endeavoring to be a part of finishing the mission. So some of the reason for why Kazakh is... This might be too small to see, but this is a chart showing the amount of natural disasters in a year. And you can see it was pretty low. For like 80 years ago, this was down like 5, 10, maybe 20 in a bad year, natural disasters in 1 year. And the last 20 years, this is up between 3 and 400 per year. And I'm no geologist or scientist or prophet. I cannot tell you why that is. I don't know. But I can tell you that it creates a big problem and a big need. Natural disasters count for approximately 90,000 deaths a year, and about 160 million lives are impacted by natural disasters each year. There's, again, about 340 million people in America, so 160 million is almost half. Can you imagine if every second person in all of America was impacted, lost something directly from some natural disaster every single year? It's a big need. And this does not account for the over 40 currently active war zones and conflict areas around the world and all of the drama that that brings. So there is a big need. There are a lot of people who have physical needs and spiritual needs. So what is Kazakh? Kazakh is a professional rescue and rapid response organization to both man-made and natural disasters. We have a training academy that combines classroom instruction within the field training, a lot of hands-on experiential learning. Our cadets get trained to an incredibly high skill level in a variety of skill sets, ropes, diving, medical, technology, like you name it, all kinds of different pieces. And our deployments always focus on hard-to-reach areas and unreached people groups. We want to go to the places that no one wants to go to. And what makes Kazakh unique? So this first one is really important to me. We send spiritual warriors into places where evil is unchecked. So in these places of disasters, where people have lost, where people are desperate and at the end of their rope, Satan loves to capitalize on that. He loves to take advantage of those people to bring bondage, to bring depression, to drive them to do things that they wouldn't normally do. Like, they're desperate, and Satan capitalizes on that vulnerability. We want to send spiritual warriors into these places to help these people with their physical needs, and also like to fight for them in a spiritual sense, to stand in the gap where people are most vulnerable. Because in these places, that is also where they are the most open to hearing the gospel. Because they are desperate, they are in need, and they're vulnerable. They're willing to hear things that they wouldn't normally be. So that's where Kazakh wants to go. A holistic approach. One of the most holistic approaches that I have seen. And what I mean by holistic is whole heart, body, soul, and spirit. Like, spiritually, physically, and emotionally, to engage with people. Like, to help people in these areas with their physical needs, not to ignore that piece and just do, like, spiritual outreach and evangelism. And not just to help their physical needs and forget the spiritual piece, but all of that, to help people through their emotional trauma and their spiritual and physical needs. And that is reflected in our training as well, to prepare our cadets physically, emotionally, and spiritually to be healthy and ready to engage in these places. Cool side note is that the training is so intense that at the end of only 4 years, you come away with a master's degree, doing nothing extra, just the training that we designed for what was necessary for the cadets. We worked with Anchor Christian University, and they said that it was worth credits. And so we actually are able to provide a degree, which we'll talk a little bit about later. Our goal is truly to just equip a generation of leaders with skills and experience to impact the world wherever they go. Our vision statement is really simple and connects to what we talked about earlier. It is to finish the mission. Our mission statement is to train and deploy specialized teams to bring leadership, humanitarian aid, and hope to war zones and high-risk areas. And our purpose statement comes from Psalms 82, 3 and 4. It's to give justice to the weak and the fatherless, maintain the right of the afflicted and destitute, rescue the weak and the needy, and deliver them from the hand of the wicked. That's what we endeavor to do. We'll talk a little bit about the Kazakh director team. A lot of them are from this area. You may know some of them. Dan Lapp is the chairman, and his job is not to be the boss man of the organization, but to equip and make sure that everybody else has the things that they need to be successful. Robert Weaver is logistics and plans a lot of deployments and those kinds of things. Human resources director and the person who takes care of people is Scott Loniger, who's also from this area. Riley Eschbach, our very own, is the PR director. Financial officer is Daniel Beachy, also from this area. Research and development, and also one of the original founders and some of the vision behind Kazakh and why it became what it is Sean Zimmerman. And educational director is David Grable. He's an absolute genius at creating the curriculum and everything that we need for the cadets. Here's a few core values of what a Kazakh cadet is. So, first of all, whole heart. And this is the piece I talked about earlier. Both whole heart in that we want everything from our cadets. We want their entire heart to be dedicated to the work that they have. We want all of them. And we also want their whole heart in the sense of spiritual, physical, and emotional, like to engage across the board with all the needs, to not let anything like lay aside. Leadership. And leadership is more than just leading people. Leadership is really important. So they're going to get into a lot of intense situations, and they're going to need to think quickly, to make decisions on the fly. They're going to need to be able to lead well and to work together as a team. So it's both to lead and also to follow. So a piece of how the teams work is that everybody is trained to a basic level in a big variety of skill sets. And then everybody also ends up specializing in one or two of those. So while everybody has some basic ropes training and water rescue, diving, those kinds of things, there'll be someone who is an expert at ropes, and someone who is an expert at water rescue, an expert at medical, so that any situation they get into, someone can take charge of that and lead it, and everyone else knows enough to be able to follow along and to be a team in that. So leading and following and working together well as a team. A culture of learning. Like a recognition that we never arrive, that there is always more to learn, like a humble spirit and always being willing to learn from team, from mentors, and always like pursuing to grow. And then just that vision for Psalms 82:3, like to rescue, In short, like we often say, to defend, protect, and keep. Who can become a Kazakh cadet? Christian, obviously. Men and women. Single or married, 18 years and older. Prior international and cross-cultural experience is needed. Ability to run a continuous mile, have a current passport, high school diploma or GED, and the ability to swim 50 feet. So it's not that complicated to try to get your foot in the door. This is a little bit of an overview of the 4 years of their main training, which some may choose to go through only 2 years, but most people will go through 4 years of training. First year is all about, like, lead yourself. Be someone worth following. Dig into your own heart and, like, your own relationship with God and set a foundation. Like, get to a place where you are ready, like, actually to be someone worth following. Year two, and year one is a lot of training. Some in the wilderness, some hands-on stuff actually deployed a few times throughout the year, and some in the classroom. But a lot of it is hands-on learning. There's a few-week stint where they're in a classroom, like really doing school. But a lot of this is experiential learning. And 6 months of this year, they will be based from home, because it is really key to us to keep them connected to home, to church, to family, and to be able to go from those places. Also, we can't be experts at everything, so we actually send them to places that have the highest level of training in the different things that they do. So the places that train them for their diving and water rescue is the same place that trains the Coast Guard. We send them out to places that are experts at what they do, but they're based from home during a lot of that year and still able to plug in at home. Year two is a lot about peer leadership. So it's about starting to work together as a team and to lead each other. Year two is a lot of deployment, a lot of hands-on training in the field. Year three, team leadership. It's where you set the standard. This is starting now to lead year one teams in some of what they do. And year four, and year three, also starting to develop some of those specialized skills in specific areas to be able to lead a team in those pieces. Year four, organizational leadership. It gives them the opportunity to do a variety of things, whether it's to jump into some of the administration of the organization, to continue to be deployed, to be on reserve duty, to add additional specializations of additional skill sets. There's a lot of options year four and beyond. Year one and two cost $20,000. It's a lot of money. And this is not nearly their whole cost. Kazakh covers, Riley, what is it, about two-thirds or something of their cost? And this is the piece left for them to pay. It's actually really expensive to work at this level, to go into these places, and to get access to them. Year two, you come away with an associate's degree. Year three is another $10,000, and a bachelor's degree is what you come away with in just 3 years. So that's pretty quick. And year four, master's degree, which is almost shockingly fast. That's a lot of school, and it's nothing extra for school. This is just for the training that they need to do what they do at the highest level. The master's degree is really cool because it opens so many doors to other places. A lot of other countries around the world, a degree is really important. It doesn't matter a ton what it's in, but school and education is so much more important there. It's hard to get a visa to get access to a lot of countries without a degree. So this piece is a really cool side benefit for the cadets, that it opens so many doors for them down the road to the places they might want to go. We have yearly evaluations because the health of our cadets is really important. They're going into a lot of intense, high-stress situations. They're going to face a lot of trauma. And it is important that they be healthy to be able to be successful in those situations. So yearly evaluations in spiritual, psychological, emotional, relational, and physical. And more than just yearly, this bleeds down to some of those evaluations are monthly or weekly or even daily connections with a mentor. They are always paired with a mentor. Daily devotions is synced across the board, and there's always a connection there to make sure that our cadets are healthy and able to continue the work that they're doing. Kazakh Advanced Team is a special hand-picked team. It's two guys and two girls that are on board and forging ahead with their training, getting ready. They will start their training in person together in August. And their purpose, they'll have 7 months of really intense training, kind of the short version running through this, and they'll be our guinea pigs for some of the curriculum that we built and stuff to be able to give us feedback on those pieces. And then they'll have 20 months of deployment after that. And these are all people with previous cross-cultural and missions experience, previous leadership skills, and are solid Christian people already. So their training really focuses on hard skills and is specific to disaster relief. And their feedback will be really important to us, and they will also be, since it'll be a couple of years until our first teams are actually deployed, this will be the teams who help lead the first full teams into their deployments and stuff. So, this is the end for the Kazakh piece. What action do we want you to take? Like, first of all, to live intentionally. And this is what I talked about earlier, of just living in a way that is outside of our comfort zone. Like, living in a way that requires God to show up or we fail. Like, not in our own strength, not just the things that we can do, but I challenge you to live in a way that, like, requires God to show up. A way that gives God an opportunity to show himself powerful, because it's when we see the most of God, it's when we experience him most closely. It's actually hard to trust God in the easy times, but when we step out, like, it's so much easier to actually trust God when we truly need him. Give him the opportunities to do the things that he wants to do. Also, become a cadet. We actually know this isn't for everybody, but we believe that there were some people that were born for this challenge, and we're excited to find them. If you want to find out more about Kazakh, you can check out the website or the Instagram. Instagram will be posting some of the stuff of the teams as they go out. You can sign up on the website for emails, or you can text this phone number to get updates and get prayer requests and some behind-the-scenes stuff if you're interested in following along with what's going on there. You can talk to Riley or myself or Dawson afterwards. So that's it for that piece. I want to close with just a little bit of an object lesson. Dawson, can you give me a hand for 1 second? You take this and just pull it down the center aisle and throw it on the floor. Stretch it all the way out. Perfect. Thanks. So I want this to be just a little bit, like, some of the things that I've talked about are hard. Like, there are sacrifices left to be made. There's a lot of work to do. There's 3 billion people who haven't heard yet, and we've gotten most of the easy ones. Like, the hard work is left to do. There's a lot of hard things ahead. And I heard someone talk recently about the passage in Revelations where John is seeing a glimpse of heaven, and there's the souls of the martyrs under an altar. And I don't know what all those things represent, but the souls of the martyrs were crying out to Jesus, to the Lamb, like, how long, O Lord, how long until you receive the glory for the sacrifice that we made? And he said, not yet. The time has not come yet. Your number is not complete. There is still blood to be shed in pursuit of reaching people. There's a lot of difficult things to do. I want to lend a little perspective to that. So let's pretend for a second that this rope is our life. And it's long, especially for those of us that are young. Life seems long, like, we know the end of the rope is over there. We don't know where the end of life is. Like, it goes on and it's almost out of sight. We go through our childhood and that's a piece of it. And then young adults, we got to this piece of life where I thought God was asking me to give up some of the best years of my life, to sacrifice them. And it turned out to be a privilege, not a sacrifice, but I didn't know that at the time. And it felt like a really big deal. That was a big chunk of this, even though life is long. But I would like to propose that actually life is really short. In the grand scheme of things, let's suggest that this piece is our life and that this is eternity afterwards. Because then those years that I thought were hard to give up are here. It's hard to even point them out. And they matter so much less because it's obvious that there's something bigger. It's obvious that these are not the most important piece. the sacrifices that we make here will be so insignificant in the larger story. We don't know where this end is. Like, we don't actually know when this happens. It can be really unexpected. Once earlier, I gave this illustration on a Sunday morning and had lunch with some friends afterwards. And the very next day, one of them was in a car accident and died. Like, that was the end of the red piece the next day. We don't know where it is. But let's make sure that the things that we do in this piece matter in this piece. Paul gave us such a cool illustration of this. Paul was a legend. First of all, Paul had everything. He had the best upbringing, the best like family. He was the highest class of people. He had the support of the high priest. Like, he was the man. He was doing good things. And then God got a hold of him and he started to do even better things that were actually good and not bad. And Paul looked at all the incredible things that he did a while later in his life. Like, that guy did so many things, like shipwreck and snake bite, and just, it goes on and on and on. Like, the story of Paul is incredible. But he looked back on it and he said, "For his sake, I have lost everything and I consider it all garbage so I may gain Christ." Because he had his eyes on this piece, not on the little red piece. And he said, "I press on toward the end of the race, toward the end of this red piece. I press on to receive the heavenly prize for which God through Christ Jesus is calling us." I love that. Like, let's press on. Let's remember how short this piece is and how insignificant the pieces are that seem so big here when we keep the perspective of the larger story. That's all I have for this morning. If you've been challenged by what we've shared this morning, like, I really just challenge you to not stay with being challenged. Like, change does not come without specific effort. I could challenge you to take action, to find the ways that you fit into God's story, to be intentional and make some goals and dig into that. If you've been inspired by this at all, if you are excited about this larger story that God is writing and the fact that he's invited you into it, I would like you to stand up. And that makes me really excited. Let's pause for a word of prayer. Father, I just come to you this morning. And Father, I thank you for the incredible story that you have been writing since the beginning of time. And that your story is about restoring us to yourself. Father, we are so unworthy and you are so incredible. And yet your story is about us. And you've given us a place in that story, each and every one of us. We're an important piece in your story. Father, sometimes it's difficult to see from inside the story, like where we fit and what's important. I just pray that you would give us all like clarity on where we fit in your story and help us to remember and to have the perspective of how insignificant sacrifices here are, and just to remember like how our stories fit into yours and that yours is the only story that matters. Father, I pray that as we go from here, you would use our lives to build your kingdom. Father, I pray that we could see the day when this mission is finished and when we're restored to perfect relationship with you. Father, keep us until that day when we stand before you in heaven. Just pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.